Martina, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Matt.
So Martina Tierney, if you don't know, is, I'm going to call you the matriarch of the Tierney family, the founder of Seat Matters and the author of this brand new book here. I'll hold it up to the camera. The Stairway of My Life. A very, very special book, which we'll get into. That is, as it says on the tin, it's all about you. And I know that this book was never written to be released publicly, that it was for your family and for your grandkids and for the legacy. And I'm grateful that it is now available for sale on Amazon. And very, very powerful story, which we will get into today. I guess as a first question, tell me about this front cover. What's going on here?
So the front cover is an image of the stairway in my own home. And it's very special to me because it is a unique staircase. You will not see that staircase in any other home. It was built by hand by my husband, James. And James was a very creative, very liked a challenge and liked to do things perfect. He was a perfectionist when it came to like woodwork and that sort of hands-on things. So we moved into our home in 1988 with no doors, internal doors, just an external door at the front and the back, and no stairs. And we had a ladder going up. And I kept saying, why have we not got stairs in the house? And he says, because I'm making them myself. And this went on for quite a while. Jonathan at that stage was about 1 year old and I was expecting Ryan. And I was climbing up and down this ladder.
Martina, that tells me so much about you that it all just starts to make perfect sense from this point on.
So I watched as James took a very large girder and he made a jig, first of all, out in the shed, which is now our office, because that shed, that office was the first building on that side.
Wow.
And he made a jig and then he took a large girder and he brought it out to the front lawn, which was not a lawn then, was just a very rough piece of grass. And he built a large fire around it. And he put the large girder and he moulded the stairway in the front garden. And I watched him from the door where the flames going around him, the smoke encircling him, and he made a very unique staircase. And it took him a very long time because he was still working during the day. So at night he would work on it. And I would go out and I would say, it looks really good now. And he would say, no, it's not quite ready yet. And he sprayed it and he painted it. And 30-something years later, it has never, ever been repainted or retouched because it's a perfect creation.
Wow.
And that's why it's on the front of the book, because it's special and it has memories and it's unique.
So that's the story behind the physical stairs. Why did you decide to title your book that?
Well, because my life has been a series of steps, I suppose. Yep. And, you know, each step, I read this thing one time, you know, the secret to success, you know, don't take the lift, take the stairs. You can't get into a lift and get to success. So I suppose the stairs also symbolises each step that I've taken on the journey that I'm now on. And I suppose the turn in the stairs too is significant, because sometimes you think you're on a path and then life takes you on another journey.
Wow.
And takes you around a corner, which you don't know what's around that corner. And that really is significant as well, I suppose. I never thought about it until you asked me the question, Matt. But in truth, I didn't know what was around the corner. And wow. I got quite shocked at some of the things that I've had to face. But as I say, life has helped me to cope with these things.
Yeah. And every step requires significant effort. I think that's what I'm hearing and seeing as well. We'll get into that. First things first, like, what's one of the first things you can remember? So this wee part of this up the stairs here, right? So this is like Martina when she was just a wee one. What's some of the first things that you, if you cast your mind back, you're able to remember?
Well, I suppose in the last 2 years, because I did write the book, I've had the opportunity to think back and to reflect on my life. And I can't remember my earliest memories, but I have early memories, if you know the difference between 100%. That. So my early memories, my father died when I was nine. there was an old man lived beside us, and he died in 1968. And I remember him. I remember quite a bit about him. So I think my earliest memories go back to when I was about six.
Nice.
Five or six. And this old man lived beside us in a little cottage. I write about it in the book. And the little cottage had just one room and an outshot. Do you know what an outshot is?
I'm going to guess it's a toilet, but I'm prepared to be wrong.
No, it's not. An outshot is a place where he slept. He just pulled a curtain round.
Oh, wow.
And he just slept at the side of the fireplace. So he had a big fireplace, an outshot with a curtain round it where he slept, a table and two big chairs. He had no indoor plumbing. And a half door. And that little cottage was right beside my home.
Wow.
And his name was Joe Nan. And we used to go to visit him all the time. And when he died, that house, that wee cottage, was left to my parents because they cared for him.
Yeah.
And they did everything for him. He was an old man that had no relatives. And that little house then became our playhouse. And that no one ever lived in it again, but me and my sisters, I'm from a very large family, we played in this house, and it was like a life-size playhouse that we were in morning,
wow,
noon and night. So my earliest memories, that would be what they would be.
Phenomenal.
A very happy childhood, I have to say.
It's great. And so you say you're from a big family, like how big is big?
Well, I'm number 13 in a family of 14.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. You weren't joking.
No. Well, there was one boy died, so I was always counted as number 12, but it was the 13th born.
Wow.
So my older brothers and sisters, some of them are in their 80s.
Unbelievable. And this cottage, like, where is that located on the map?
It's in a little town called Ribberstown.
Okay.
Outside Maharfield, and a townland called Derrynoid. And it's very rural. And very much out in the country.
Yeah.
There's no, when I was growing up, we didn't have any modern facilities at all.
Mad. Mm. What did mum and dad do?
So my dad was a farmer, and my mother was a housewife, but not just a housewife, because she kept chickens and she had eggs to, which she sold to pay for groceries. She had pigs and she sold the little pigs. So she was a housewife and a mother. But also she had her little business on the side, which I presume a lot of women did in those days as well. They had to contribute to the household and to the finances. And my father was a farmer, and we never grew up having a regular income. There was never regular money coming into the house. So it was always you were buying and selling. And I suppose that's just how we grew up. We didn't grow up knowing that where the next pound was coming from, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I don't know where I heard this, but I heard it just 3 days ago. And they were saying that actually some of the best natural entrepreneurs on the planet are people who come from farming backgrounds because of the reasons you've just laid out. Never have a regular income, always having to think about ways to solve problems, always having to think, right, how are we going to get, you know, money for March, and that will that get us through to May? And da, 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 da. It's interesting.
Yeah.
What brought you out of the family home, and what career did you go into?
Well, I suppose because we didn't have a regular income, my father was quite keen on gearing us towards sort of jobs, especially the ladies, especially the girls in the house. So my older sisters, three of them became nurses, and it was quite back in the 60s, which quite something that a lot of ladies would have done, a lot of women would have. They went into nursing, and my father was quite keen that they would get sort of steady, regular jobs. So when it came my turn, I grew up in a house where there was a lot of talk about hospitals and nursing and everything. And I heard a lot of talk about matrons and off duties and things and bedpans. And it wasn't something that I really wanted to go. But I still wanted that sort of caring atmosphere. I just liked the idea of that. Mm. So I decided I would apply for occupational therapy. So it's still in the caring profession, but it wasn't really the nursing profession, because I'd heard a lot of stories about nursing and it wasn't just something that I wanted to do. So at that time, I thought I wanted a 9-to-5, Monday to Friday job. And that's one of the reasons I applied for occupational therapy as opposed to nursing.
Right.
But as it turned out, my career did not give me a Monday to Friday 9-to-5 job. I ended up doing something completely different.
Yeah. So you talk about Jonah, and you said that your parents, they cared for him.
Yeah.
A lot of your sisters became nurses. You became an occupational therapist, and you then went on to start a business that is built on service, and it helps thousands and thousands and thousands of people around the world make their everyday life better. Mm-hmm. If you look at your parents, where does that caring nature, desire to help other people come from, do you think?
It's probably just, I don't know if it's a country thing, if it's a large family thing, but I mean, my mother cared for her mother. You know, she visited her, even though she didn't live with her and she had her own responsibilities of a very large family. She was very caring towards her mother. My grandmother apparently was the most caring person. Unfortunately, she died when I was about six, so I don't remember a lot about her, but my older brothers and sisters would say she was very caring. So that very caring, and from a large family too, I think you really do learn to look after each other and look out for each other. And the older ones in the family look after us. And then we had nieces and nephews when I was six. So we started looking after nieces and nephews and babysitting. And I don't know if it's that or if it's a country thing, but that it's just natural to me to just care for people and to look out for them.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking off mic before we started and you just mentioned a few things that you were doing this week. And I was like, wow, this is genuinely just who you are. You know, it's built in you to care for other people. Okay, a bend in the staircase maybe. Mm-hmm. How do you go from being an OT to getting into something completely different?
Well, I suppose it's not completely different. Like I was an OT and what I thought I wanted was a 9-to-5 Monday to Friday job. That's what I thought I wanted. But when I got into that, I didn't sit with me at all. I didn't like the restrictions around a job. I didn't like the hours around a job. And I didn't like the sort of ceiling that doesn't matter how much you cared or how much you worked, you still got the same response at the end of the month. And I could just see that this wasn't for me. Mm. But at that early days, like I was reared in a family and it just sort of, I went along with it for a while and I loved my patients. But I didn't like the system. And then in the year 2000, I was 15 years in OT at that stage. I just said to James one day, I'm going to do something different. And I met James when I was 17 and he had never had a job in his life.
Wow.
That doesn't mean he didn't work. That means he never worked for anybody else. When he was 17, he left the university. He didn't go to university. He left... like a college in Derry.
Yeah.
Like, and he had learned to be woodwork and all that hands-on. And the first job he got was putting roof on houses in Limavady. There was a place being built called Whitehill and he was putting the roof on the houses. But again, because no matter how hard he worked, he got the same money at the end of the week. Mm. So he went to the contractor and he said, I'll give you a price for doing all these houses. He says, and I work away at my own pace. So he got a price for doing all the houses and he worked away and he just worked day and night, Saturdays and Sundays and everything, bank holidays. And then he was making so much more money than the person who was just working for a wage. So from age 17, he started to be working for himself. So when I said, I really want to do something for myself, he just says, well, when are you starting? You know, he really did. That was the words he said. When are you starting? He didn't question the fact that I was giving up a responsible, pensionable, secure job. He just says, well, when are you starting and what are you going to do? Mm. So he definitely was the person who gave me the courage.
Yeah.
We talked about that at the Lean Summit. What is encouragement? Encouragement is someone who gives you courage. And he absolutely was my encourager because he gave me the courage to just step out of what was then a very secure, pensionable job. I mean, most of my colleagues knew would be retired at this stage, living on a pension. But that was never something that I thought I needed. I just thought I'll work that out when the time comes.
Yeah.
I'll figure that out.
Yeah.
It's more important what I do from now to retirement than really thinking about retirement.
Sure. It's really interesting. That reminds me something that Martin said whenever your three sons were in here a couple of weeks ago. Whenever Martin was thinking about dropping out of school and you gave him some advice and I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? Do you remember what you said to him?
I'm going to tell you something different from he said, but I remember him saying that I'm only going to do my A-levels to prove that I can get four A's.
Yeah.
And I says to Martin, well, you have proved from the day you went to school that you're an A student. He did. He always was proved. As you don't have to do it to prove it to me or to anybody else. You need to have other reasons for doing A-levels.
Yeah.
And then we thought, well, you could be a solicitor, you could be an accountant, you could be all these things. And Jonathan said, but he can't be everything. You know, so if he can't be an accountant, a solicitor and all the things we needed for the business. And the thing he really wanted to do was be part of, you know, growing the business. And I just advised him, if that's what the only reason he was staying at school was to prove that he was getting A-level, could get A's at A-levels, well, that wasn't the right reason to stay.
Yeah.
Is that what he told you?
Yeah, 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 exactly. And, I, you know, it's not the typical advice that you would think of a typical Northern Irish mum to give to their kid. Yeah, yeah, drop out of school in your final year. That's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. But you guys, and it kind of saw it reflected in that story that you said about James kind of breathing courage into you.
Mm-hmm.
You have this belief that's like, yeah, yeah, just go for it. Like, when are you starting? Like, why are you delaying what you know you're already going to do?
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
That's true.
Talk to me about the shed.
Oh, the shed. So James decided he wanted, obviously, to build his own house. It was never a question that we would buy a house. So we had to build our own house. So we got this little farm that belonged to his ancestors, and we bought this farm for £8,000, 13 acres. And the first thing he did was, he said, the first thing we need a shed on this, because if we're going to build a house, he's very practically minded, we need a shed to put all the equipment and the tools and everything in it. So we built the shed first. And that was the first building on the 13 acres. And that shed, we lived in it, in a mobile home. That was the first use of it. The second, then it became the disability centre when I decided I was going to start my own business. We renovated it then. It became the disability centre, and it has changed and grown, and it is now like an office that holds all our marketing people. So that first building is actually the shed where we actually started our life on there in a caravan.
Crazy.
It is mad when I think of it now.
And at what point did the idea to start making seats come into the picture?
Well, I left my job because, as I said earlier, you know, I was felt restricted in the job. But I loved the patients. So I decided that what I would do is I would set up what was the first assessment centre in Northern Ireland, privately owned. And I would offer people the opportunity to have a proper assessment of foreign piece of equipment that they wanted to purchase for themselves. Because what the patients were doing is they were going out to buy chairs and beds and scooters and wheelchairs that were not appropriate to meet their needs. And they were spending lots of money. So I thought there's a niche here that I could offer them proper advice and assessment before the purchase. So that's what I did. And then what I found when I went out to care homes in order to promote what I was doing, what I found was chairs was the biggest problem that people had in care homes. They were sliding out of chairs, they were falling in chairs. Care staff were having difficulty managing people in the chairs that were available. So I started to source chairs from other companies. And when the chairs would come in, because I had done a lot of more training in seating and posture management and the importance of seating, I realised that the chairs were not exactly the way they should be. So James, again, being very creative and inventive and courageous, he would adapt the chair to meet the needs of the patient. So it was sort of one by one. As the chair come in, I would say, I need the foot plate higher. I need the headrest better. I need higher arms or whatever I needed. So he would adapt the chair to meet the patient's needs. And then one day, as I say in the book, James just said, why don't we start from scratch? He said, you know what you need clinically and I know I can do it. And it was his confidence in me as a clinician and his own confidence in himself as somebody who could do it that was a winning team, really, because he believed that I knew what I was talking about and he knew that he could actually meet that need. So that's how we ended up doing Seating Matters. Mm-hmm.
And it's grown into...
Well, it has grown more than I ever expected. Because my goal, and I was always one for writing down goals, and I have an old diary at home, and in the old diary it says, to be the seating specialist for Ireland.
Wow.
That's what's in my diary. And I think it was 2005 or six. I had that written down.
Yeah.
And it said the seating specialist, because at that time we weren't actually manufacturing, but I was doing a lot of assessment and a lot of provision and that. But I had this goal that I would be the seating specialist of Ireland. And that, to me, that was a very big goal.
Yeah.
But we didn't, I never really envisaged that it would go to the UK and then go to Australia and then go to Canada and Europe. But it was really the boys, my three sons, that really pushed it to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting how sometimes the people that follow after you can actually push your thing beyond what you thought it was going to be. One of the things we talked about with the three guys when they're in was, you know that phrase, like standing on the shoulders of giants? It's like your and James's courage to start gave them shoulders to stand on so that they could then go to Australia and then go to the UK and then go to all these places. But what do you have like 60 team members now?
Yes, we've about 60 in the factory, yeah. And then we would have like a team out selling that I don't even know who are, because, you know, we have contracts with different companies and we have more people out there working for Seating Matters that we wouldn't even really know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But directly in the factory, there's about 60 people that we actually employ. So even that has grown. And it's really good to have that facility there to provide employment for our local people, because you've been there, Matthew, and you know that we're really out in the country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That 13 acres that we bought is now almost concreted over. So it is with, because that's where we built the business. We continue to expand and build more factory and concrete. And so that 13 acres, we never moved from there. Like, we had plans of moving to a more industrial area, but it works where it is. It's out in the country, but it works.
It's so funny. Like, I always say this, like, even to Mark and Daniel, the first time I drove up to see Ryan, I remember thinking, oh, surely I've put it
took a wrong
turn. Do you know what I mean? Like, this can't be where it is. And all of a sudden, wow, you're here in this this amazing facility. This is, I don't know why this is in my head. Sometimes questions go around my head and I have to almost get them out just to make it go away. See, whenever you were bespoken chairs.
Yes.
And, you know, you would say, look, James, I need this foot plate up, you know, three inches higher, whatever it was. Where did you have that information? Like, would you have had all that, like, jotted down in a wee book whenever you'd done the assessment with somebody?
Yeah. Well, what I did, and this is something I've always done, where I decided that I was going to become a more specialist in seating, I went and I learned as much as I could. So I'd done a lot of more training. I paid for the training myself. I went on courses. I'd done a postgraduate module at Ulster University and I tried to learn as much as I could about seating. So then each person was individually assessed for the chair. So when I would do the assessment, I would look at their posture, I would measure them up, and I knew exactly what I needed for that patient. Yeah. But when the chair came in, because the chairs weren't adjustable enough or adaptable enough, they weren't really meeting the needs of the patient. So therefore, that's when we did the bespoke for the patient.
Yeah.
And in a way, that has been a godsend and a blessing and a curse at the same time, because we've become known as the people who do bespoke.
Right.
But we also do a lot of, run-of-the-mill sort of
replicatable
type chairs
as
standardized
well. Things. Yeah. Yeah.
But we have become known that if you have a problem, Seating Matters will sort it out. But if you just need a standard chair, go somewhere else. So sort of it became a blessing and a curse at the same time. But at the end of the day, we're meeting patient needs.
100%.
And I just think if we keep doing that, that is the secret of success, because we have to be able to meet the patient needs regardless of how many chairs we sell. And that I've always put that into my, first of all, my three sons. Because I remember one time, Jonathan went out to do an assessment in Wales and I was at home, and it was for a specific chair they wanted. And when he went into that home, he realised that that was not the right chair for the patient. But they were insisting that they would have it because another company had said, this is the type of chair you need.
Right, okay.
So Jonathan came out to the van and he rang me. I was back home and he says, Mum, this chair is a more expensive chair. It's the one they want, but it's not the right chair. It's the Atlanta chair they need. And you won't know the names of the chairs, but the Atlanta chair is a much safer chair for somebody who's quite difficult to seat. And I said, Jonathan, you must always do the right thing. Just walk away from the assessment. If they are insistent on buying the other chair, That can't be your decision. You can't sell them a chair. That's not right. And that was that. That was many, many years ago. But that was just teaching him that you must always do the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Powerful.
Yeah.
So you go from, tell me about your first few chairs. Like, that must have been mad to go from bespoke chairs to building from scratch. Like, what was that like?
Well, if you read this book, you will see that it was a bit of a struggle because it happened quicker than we wanted to happen. Because we were planning on making our own brand of chairs. This was something we had going on in the background. But we were still bringing in chairs from other companies. Mm-hmm. But very suddenly, the other company that was supplying us with chairs cut off our supply of chairs. Oh. They had their own reasons for doing it. It was a business decision that they made. And it was very sudden, and we got 4 weeks' notice that we no longer had a supply of chairs from the UK. So that we had already started the process of designing our own chairs, and thankfully Martin did leave school at that time. He left in the January, I think, and we got this call in February the 6th because it was my husband James's birthday, and that's why I'll never forget that date. And on the 6th of February 2008, we got a call to say, well, I met with a person actually at the airport down here in Belfast. And he said, you no longer have our chairs. He says, you have 4 weeks. And I was totally shocked because we had no pre-warning. And I went back home. Of course, I was in floods of tears. And James says, oh, we'll figure it out. We'll do something. Don't worry. And he reassured me, but I was still a bit stressed about it. But from that was February, and we had to pull all the stops out, and we had chairs out on the market in June in a hotel down here in Belfast. We did our launch, and we invited all the occupational therapists that we had done business with. We invited all the companies, and two of the companies that came that day are still distributing for us.
Unbelievable.
Now, they were not perfect. In fact, they were far from it. The good thing was any of the issues we had at that stage, they were all like technical issues. No patient was ever harmed or anything. But, you know, foot plates might have been a bit loose and, you know, because things were rushed.
100%.
Because if we didn't, we had to get them out to market very quick because that vacuum had been created and somebody else was going to fill it. You know, if I didn't get back out there with a product, somebody was going to fill that vacuum that I had spent the last 8 years building up.
Yeah.
So we had to get something to market very quick. And I have to be very grateful to the support I got in Northern Ireland from my colleagues, my OT friends. Mm. They called them Martina's chairs. You know, we're going to try Martina's chairs. And they did try the chairs and they gave me feedback and said this. Right. So I'm very, very grateful to the customers and my OTs and the nursing homes in Northern Ireland because they definitely did support us in those early days. And they did live with us through those challenges, and we, you know, we looked after them, but they fed back to us mm-hmm. about what we could do better and everything. And it was just, it actually, maybe that's meant to be, just a real big push. And then within a year we were in the UK selling those chairs.
Crazy.
So the next year we were in the UK.
Yeah.
So maybe we needed that push, but at the time it didn't feel very good.
Yeah, I bet. When was the first time that a chair was made by someone who's not the family?
By someone who's not the family? Would have seen. It was quite a while because Ryan Willie would have had his hands on there for many, many years. What year are we on now? 20? I would say in the last maybe 10 years, we've sort of definitely not moved away, but we've sort of taken more of an overview of the company and brought in people. And what we realised, I think our boys like this saying that, you know, you need to employ people who are smarter than you and can do a thing better than you. You know, we've brought in a lot more people, you know, designers and technicians, and we've brought in a lot more very high-tech machinery, CNC machines, and everything at the beginning was actually built by hand, you know, very much one-on-one. And also we would have outsourced a lot of those products, like the welding, the wood would have been outsourced to other people. Whereas nowadays that's all in-house. Mm. And therefore we don't have, as like Ryan can allow other people to Although we're not very far removed from the actual manufacturing, because we do keep a very close eye on, you know, the product.
Yeah, and it's happening before your very eyes.
Yeah.
Very cool. So if you think about more turns in the staircase, mm-hmm. in your business journey, there was a really significant turn, and that was the passing of James. What was, we'll go pure business.
Right.
What, how did that impact the business?
Well, it knocked us off course for a while. Especially the boys, because I call them boys. They're not meant to be called boys.
They'll always
adults.
Always be your boys, though.
I suppose James was a very, he was very influential. He was a very strong character. He was very determined, courageous, and he never really let anything bother him. So if the challenge came up, he just dealt with it. You know, he didn't worry about things. So therefore, when we were building the business, even though he wasn't 100% in the business, because he still had his own construction business, he was always there. He was always the support. If there was something went wrong, Daddy, call on Daddy, we'll ask Daddy for his advice. He also, obviously, to the financial, at the beginning, he was the financial support as well. He helped us get up and running. So very much the... he was the structure for mm-hmm. the business and somebody that you could depend on. And when he got sick, I suppose looking back, we're very fortunate. People mightn't think that, but we're very fortunate that we had 2 years with James from he got sick until he passed away. A lot of people, somebody just dies very sudden. And those 2 years were very difficult because we were trying to find cures. We were trying to get him treatment. And everything, but those 2 years gave us a chance, first of all, to appreciate James and what he had to offer us and what he appreciate him, and also give us time to adjust to James not being there. And we wanted to take away a lot of the challenges that we were still having. We didn't really want to burden him with them because he was going through really quite difficult treatment and that at the time. So those 2 years give us a bit of an idea what it's going to be like if James is no longer with us. Although I never, personally, I never really give in that he was going to die. But it did give that little period of time of adjustment. But when he actually did pass, it was very difficult because you think you're prepared and then you're not. And I remember Ryan coming in one day and sitting at our very big table and sat across the table and he says, I don't know what to do. And I says, why do you not know what to do? He says, because I don't know what Daddy would have wanted. And I remember, and it was only maybe 3 weeks, and I remember saying, you are going to have to figure out your way of doing it. Yeah. You can't always look to see what would Daddy have said, what would Daddy have done.
Yeah.
You're going to have to figure this out yourself. And after he died, but the year after he died, I wrote this poem. And the poem's in the book. And it just came to me, this poem. And one of the lines in the poem says, he stepped aside to let us grow, but he hasn't gone away. He's there beside us every day, we just have to say. And I really, really believe that he was such a significant part of our lives and such a very strong character that we would always have depended on him had he always been there. And although we weren't prepared to lose him and he wasn't prepared to go, at some very deep level, that was the way it was meant to be. That he was meant to move aside to let the boys grow and to let me grow, because even though I was quite an independent person, I was always a wee bit in his shadow because I really depended on his judgment. I depended on his encouragement. I always went to him to see, what do you think? And now then I have to now think, what do I think?
Yeah.
You know, and my sons and my daughter as well, they have to just think, well, what do I think about this? What do we think? Rather than, and I do see that in other businesses where the father's still there, that the sons and the daughters, they don't grow the same, you know, because they don't have the responsibility.
Yeah.
They don't have the last, you know, say the buck doesn't stop.
Yeah.
And I see that, and I know a few other families where the father's still there, That's not to say we wouldn't still want James. Of course we would. That's not. But you have to find a way to, you have to find a way when you're dealt this, you have to look at it and say, well, what's the positive in this? Mm-hmm. Because if you keep looking at the negative, you just can't move forward. And I had to just think, well, why did he go? Or why did he have to die so soon? And that's just the, what I came up with. Yeah. He stepped aside to let us grow.
It's powerful. Mm-hmm. It's interesting if we were to look at the transcript of this podcast episode and we were to search through the words, there's a word that has come up, I'm just going to guess, probably 15 to 20 times. And it's actually a phrase, sorry. It's, we'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And if you look up there, is it up there? Yeah, do you see up there? It says, we'll figure it out. Uh-huh. I gave one of them to Martin because in the podcast we did with the brothers, as we call them, your sons, the boys, as you said, Martin kept saying that phrase, we'll figure it out, we'll figure it out. Uh-huh. And I've heard you quote James multiple times saying, we'll figure it out. Something happens, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And what is it that you told Ryan whenever he was sitting at the table across from you? Mm-hmm. Says, you have to learn to figure it out yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that, I don't know if it's an ability, I don't know if it's a belief, but that trait is almost like the trait of all traits. If you can really believe, oh yeah, we'll figure it out, there's almost nothing that you can't walk through.
Yeah. That's always been, and I don't know where it came from. You know, I really don't. I don't know where it came from. I know for many years when we were younger, we did read a lot of books. We did listen to a lot of CDs, as it was then. And, you know, we did a lot of motivational seminars and things. But I don't know if we got it from there or if we were attracted to that sort of information. But it has always been our attitude, you know, that we just get on with it.
Yeah.
You know, don't complain, just get on with it. So,
I know you said that there was a part of you that never accepted or believed that he was actually going to pass. How do you start to, I'm thinking now, you know, I'm married, you know, we're only married, 7 years with a 3-year-old and a 3-month-old. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine knowing that anyone in my family was going to die. And then having to somehow prepare to say goodbye to them. Like, how on earth do you even start to approach that?
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that when we got the diagnosis of James's cancer, that I just thought, how am I going to watch him die? I just couldn't figure out how I was going to do that.
Yeah.
You know. He's a big, strong man. I don't know. I just didn't know how I was going to do that.
Yeah.
But how I did it was, for the 2 years leading up to this, we were determined to find a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent 2 years looking for a solution of all sorts. We went to America. We did all the healthy eating. We did the wheatgrass. We did all the psychological, that positive thinking.
Yep.
We did everything that we could. And I never give in until the night before, the Saturday night. I had never given, and James never mentioned death to me, and I never mentioned death to him.
Wow.
I don't know if that's a good thing, but that was how we dealt with it.
Yeah.
And on the night before, James, he was very ill on Saturday night. He was really ill and he was at home. And I called Jonathan up and I says to Jonathan, this isn't working.
Mm.
I says, I'm going to have to let him go because he's only holding on for me. And John says, I know. And I think when I look back on it now, I think Jonathan already had given and maybe everybody else around me had given except me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into the room and I said to James, this isn't working. You know, I'll never forget you, but this is not working and I'm going to have to give in. And he said, oh, well, not worry about it tonight, he says. Get onto bed. That was what he said. Well, not worry about it tonight. And I got into the bed. I've this in the book too. It's quite hard to read it back. And I got into bed and I actually slept. And we got up in the morning. He was still in a lot of pain. He wouldn't go into the hospital the night before. And I said, I'm going to call the doctor. And he said, no, I'm going into the hospital. And I had to then say, where do you want to be buried? First time ever I had to ask him. I had to face all the questions.
Yeah.
You know, but, and we were able to do it. I don't know where I got the strength to ask him those questions, and we talked about it. And I'm sure the boys told you what his last words to them was. Did they ever tell you what those were?
Tell us now.
He said, Ryan again said, Daddy, Daddy, what do you want us to do? And I don't know what Ryan really meant by that, because there was nothing more we could have done. Yeah. And he says, make plenty of money and enjoy it. That was his last words to them. So it was. That was the last thing he said, make plenty of money and enjoy it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So, two very different things.
Mm-hmm.
Two very different things, because plenty of people can do one but not the other.
Yeah. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but I don't know if you... I just didn't give in that he was going to die. That was how I coped with the 2 years.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking we're going to find a solution. But I really truly believe that he isn't away. And that's why I thought the book was important for other people. If you could ever, once you lose somebody, if you could ever get yourself to that point of accepting that their physical body is gone, but their influence, their spirit is still here, that's what helps me to cope. I know having we're physical beings and we like to be able to see and smell and taste and touch and, you know, all that. But I think if you could ever get to the point, which I have got to, thankfully, where I totally believe that he's still here, that he still influences our life, he still helps us, then that gives me a lot of consolation and eager to go on.
Yeah. Brilliant. Mm. Well, I appreciate you sharing everything you shared there.
Yeah.
Past it. Hard pivot. I always like to call it out whenever it just makes no sense. Like, we're just going to hard shift the gears here. Okay. You talk about, you know, James stepping aside. How have you navigated stepping aside in the business? Like, what are you currently doing now? Was there ever a moment where you took like a very active or clear step back, or was there ever a point you had to step aside business-wise, I guess is what I'm trying to say?
Well, again, I have to give James the credit for this as well, because it's really hard for people outside to believe what I believe, but very early on when we moved from the disability centre to Seating Matters and we started manufacturing the chairs, I was the director, Jonathan was there at the time, Martin and Ryan still hadn't come into the business, then they came into the business and James said to me, you just hand over that business to them. He says, because if they own the business, you won't have to wake them in the morning to get them up and go to work. He says, and you don't want them working for their mummy or their daddy.
Right.
So like from very early on, I took a step back then.
Yeah.
Now, I was working full time. I was doing all the assessments. I had all the clinical input and everything. But it was a clear indication to them, this is your business, right? And it was James's idea to do that. And then roll on then to James got ill and I took a complete step back at that time because my priority was James looking after. He needed a lot of help. We were going to hospitals every day. He needed special diet. So I took a complete step back at that time. And lucky enough, Ryan's girlfriend at the time, wife now, Olivia, was an OT and she stepped in and she'd done a lot of the work for me.
Class.
So that was when I took a big step back. But then once James passed away and a few months later, I got straight back in there. And again, from a clinical perspective, I've always kept my hand in.
Mm-hmm.
But from a business perspective, I've taken a step back and let them get on with it because I never wanted to hold them back if they had big ideas and big dreams.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to be the one that would think, oh, God, that's a bit risky or something. So I really, from a business perspective, I let them make the decisions. And as long as clinically everything is going right and the research is done and the patient's being cared for, and just this year, we have employed a full-time OT just from January this year. And again, I'm moving back. She's very, very good. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that she will take over a lot of the work that I do. And I am gradually moving away but I'll never really completely move out because you can't, it's like leaving your family. Like you don't retire from being a mother, you don't retire from being a grandmother, and you can't retire from being the OT and seating matters.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. So I'll always be part of it, mm-hmm. but I don't want to be tied, you know, to the work all the time, because at my age now, I want to be able to do the things that this is the first time in my life that I don't really have responsibilities. I don't have a husband to think about, unfortunately. I don't have children now because they're all married and independent. And it's the first time that I'm going to do things for myself. So
class. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There's a lovely moment at the Lean Summit at the very end where all the Seton Matters team jumped up on stage. And I do this thing, and I was telling Daniel this the other day, I always like to watch other people react to certain things. And my eye caught you, and I just saw your face, and you had such a proud look on your face of all of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real, you could just sense that sense of pride that you had for every single one of mm-hmm. the people on the Seton Matters team. Mm-hmm. And that must have been a nice feeling for you.
It is, and they are a great bunch of people. Like, they are so dedicated to what they're doing, and you know, it's just so good for us to be able to provide employment for them. But what I learned as well is, and I heard it at the conference, they are providing a lifestyle for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we didn't have those people working there and being dedicated to their job and what they're doing,
100%.
We wouldn't have the lifestyle we have. So it's a one-one situation.
Yeah. That was one of our big takeaways. Mm-hmm. We talk about that all the time. I don't know if it was Mr. Amazawa or whoever said it.
Somebody said it,
but they said, you know, as business leaders and owners, you work for your
mm-hmm.
team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they are the people you serve. Mm-hmm. And that, I just find that really mm-hmm. powerful. Yeah. And then when you say it out loud, well, of course. You know what I mean? It seems obvious.
Yeah.
So you're in your retirement years. You know.
Well, I'm getting there.
That's why anyone who's I'm not watching on video. I'm doing the mm-hmm. the bunny years.
Mm-hmm.
Because your peers are in their retirement years.
Yeah, most of my peers would have retired at this stage.
Like, you're not, you know, sipping Mai Tais on the beach 9 to 5. What does the next season of your life look like? What are you up to?
Well, I do a lot of walking. I don't know. I do a lot of hill walking. I just did Kirkpatrick last weekend, so I do a lot of hill walking. I've done the Camino twice.
Unreal.
And I'm doing it again next year. So I love the outdoors. I love walking. I love being on my own, mm-hmm. but not being lonely. So I don't really head off to the Himalayas or somewhere completely on my own. But I like doing things on my own, but not to feel alone, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I want to be there in the business for important events, you know, and meet up with people, or, you know, it's more... At this point in my life now, it's more about the relationships,
mm-hmm.
building relationships with people as opposed to going out and doing training. My staff can do the training now. They're well trained to do that. But just to build relationships with customers, with other companies. So I want to continue to do that. And what else do I want to do? I just want to travel the world.
Yeah, you got the travel fever.
I've got the travel fever.
Do you really? Wow.
I do.
Have you been to Japan?
I have been to Japan. Yeah, I've been to
after
Toyota.
After the summit, I'm just Japan on the brain. I'm like, look me, when are we getting over here?
Yeah,
like?
No, I've been to Japan. And this next year, I want to do India, and I want to do South Africa as well. So I'm going to try and do that. But I also have the grandchildren, which are a very important part of my life. And I like taking them. We have a house in Donegal, and I like taking them away and have the boys hill walking. And the girls doing different things. So I like to do that as well. So I want to spend more quality time with them in the next year.
What is it about the Camino that's bringing you back for a third time?
Oh, I don't know. The Camino is peaceful. It's just very uplifting.
Mm.
It's the weather as well. It's the scenery. It's just the freedom of getting out on the road and just walking and... being surrounded by people, like-minded people, but being on your own to allow your time to think. And I love walking mm-hmm. and I love, but Camino is very special and I really can't wait to get back to it. Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
If you could go out for a cup of coffee or tea or a glass of wine or a pint, whatever you fancy, with someone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, who would you take and where would you take them? And why?
Oh, Well, I like good conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I like good, meaningful conversation. I like talking about spiritual things. And I don't know, I haven't had the chance to have a coffee with this person yet. And he might listen to this and he might not. But I've had fleeting conversations with Brendan McGorgan.
Oh, yes.
From Scale X. Just meeting him here and there. And I think he would be the sort of person that I would like to sit down and have a real good conversation with, because he sort of thinks the way I think.
Yeah.
And not many people do think like us, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that deep, meaningful conversation and talk a little bit more about deeper things.
Yeah.
So maybe Brendan, if he's listening, maybe we'll go for a coffee sometime.
That's a great answer. And we had Brendan in here a couple of weeks ago.
All right. Didn't realize that.
He definitely would love that chat and love that conversation. So
I am doing that. He has a summit coming up in the waterfront.
That's right.
Is it the waterfront or the
SSC? It is. It's the ICC, they call ICC, it now, but it is the waterfront. It will always be the waterfront to me. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going there for the day.
Roscoe, can you type into Google Scale X Summit just so I get the date right for that? I think it's the 15th of November.
I think you're right, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that's going to be a great event.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. Roscoe will keep me right here with a fact check. Kind of a closing question. There's two questions I'd like to ask to finish. The first one is where we usually end, and then I'm going to throw in a wee bonus, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, sure, no pressure. I love asking people, if you could go back in time, you know, way back to one of these first steps on the staircase of your life, say to whenever you were 18 years old, and you had a couple of minutes of 18-year-old Martina's time, what sort of things would you say to her?
Oh, I definitely know what I would say to her now when you think of it. I would tell her not to worry so much about things, because as an 18-year-old or, you know, at school, I talk about this in the book as well. I was quite an anxious person.
Mm-hmm.
I would have had panic attacks and anxiety. And as I got older, I didn't go for any sort of proper treatment. No, it wasn't really at that stage, but I learned how to cope with anxiety. So I would tell my 18-year-old self to not worry so much, that things always do work out one way or the other.
Mm.
And I have to tell myself that every day, even now.
Yeah.
But if I could have learned it earlier, I might have had less anxiety in my life. So I think not to worry so much and not to be so anxious about the future.
Very good
advice.
Does
that answer your question?
It does indeed, yeah. Roscoe's waving at me. Scale X Summit. Can you read it to me? I actually just can't read it. What is it
you need to know?
The date, what's the date?
15th of November. Ah. From 8:30 to, yeah.
Awesome, yeah. I'm really looking forward to that. It'll be a good one. This is a bonus question. So I sometimes throw this in, sometimes don't. And it's the sort of question where if you sat down and you really thought about it, like, you could probably get a right answer, but we're looking for the first reaction or maybe the first thing that pops into your head.
Right.
And it's very simply this. What is the kindest thing that someone has ever done for you?
What is the kindest thing that someone has ever done for me? Oh, I know what it is.
I love it. Let's go. Let's go, Martina. I'm buckling up.
And the person that this will be such a shock to this person. Ryan got married in December, and I've never had the chance to tell this person. Ryan got married in the December after James passed away. He died in September the 8th, and Ryan got married in December. And it was a very stressful lead up to the wedding, and what was a very large wedding, because there were so many people had spent 2 years in our house supporting us. So we had a very big, this was Ryan's way of saying thank you to people.
Yeah.
So it was a very large wedding. And Ryan was very adamant that I wasn't having any, you know, major role. I didn't have to carry out gifts. I didn't have to read. I didn't have to end, because he knew, like, it was a stressful time.
Sure.
So I was sitting at the front of the church, and I was in the seat of my own, because the three boys were on, the one was a groom, two best men, and Louise was a bridesmaid. So sitting in the front row on my own. And the ceremony proceeded. My sister and brother-in-law came up and sat beside me. And then when we went to walk down the aisle after the bride and groom, I suddenly realised I'm on my own here.
Mm.
Nobody had planned who was going to walk down the aisle with me.
Of course.
Because, like, it was a minor detail, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was a huge thing when it happened.
Yeah.
I just suddenly thought, I'm on my own here.
Yeah.
And Olivia's mother reached for my hand. And me and her, the two mothers, walked down the aisle.
Wow.
And I don't know what happened. Poor Pat, the father.
He had to fend for himself.
But it was, and I've never talked about that. And I've never told that to anyone. And I definitely haven't told Irene. But I have to say, that was the kindest thing everybody ever done to me. Because at that very minute,
yeah,
I felt completely alone.
Absolutely.
And I thought, there's nobody to walk down the aisle with.
Yeah.
And she just reached for my hand and the two of us walked down there, the two mothers, and it was the perfect scenario. Now then when it came to the next wedding, which was Martin's a few months later, I had lined somebody up to walk me down there.
That was your improvement. I like that.
You come and be there to walk me down the aisle, but I had time to think about it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something that you would ever have thought of in advance.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know. But I would say that was the kindest thing anybody ever done for me.
Well, I'm very glad that we asked because that was a great way to end.
Yeah.
The Stairway of My Life, it's on Amazon. We will put a link to it in the description. And Martina, I can't thank you enough. This has been genuinely really, really fun and really insightful. And thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt.
Awesome.
Thank you.
See you again next time. Thanks a lot.